What I want to do is to set the stage, if you will, for the rest of the day, and also talk about some of our experience and some of our lessons learned, because we've been going at this for more than 20 years, and we haven't done everything perfectly, believe it or not. So I think there are probably some lessons to be learned, and I hope there are a few positive things to be learned as well. I'm going to start with an overview of the Chesapeake and its watershed. It's about 165,000 square kilometer land area. It's a very shallow watershed, an average depth of about 7 meters. It has a land area to water volume ratio of just under 2,400 to 1, which is 6 times larger than the next estuary, the Bay of Finland, in the world. And that's why what happens on the land is so, so critical in the Chesapeake. It also is why it was so productive in its native state, because it got nutrients, you know, the things we get too much of now, it got. 16 million people and growing, 3 major animal producing areas, and cropping areas, systems near the bay are dominated by corn, soybeans, and wheat, more forages as we move inland. Couple of pretty pictures. This is the narrowest place on the bay where the Bay Bridge crosses. Here it's only about 8 kilometers wide. It's more typically 20 to 40 kilometers wide. It has great economic significance historically as a harvest area for fish and shellfish, and of course our blue crab, Atlantic blue crab, is the pride of the Chesapeake, but we are eating a lot more of them that speak with a Cajun accent as we have overworked our stocks and are having to ship up from Louisiana. The other change that's occurring that is very important from a water quality standpoint, because the expectations of that 16 million people are for a clean bay, and it actually has a higher value in terms of its recreational use than its commercial use now, both as a sailing mecca and particularly since restoration of the striped bass, our rockfish, for fishermen. And it also raises the value of all land near the bay. The major watersheds of the Chesapeake, really 3 watersheds, cover over 80% of, or about 80% of the land area. And the Susquehanna covers half of that land area. So it's easy to talk about both the Susquehanna and the bay at one time. The bay watershed encompasses 6 states in the parts of 6 states in the District of Columbia. The Susquehanna encompasses mainly in Pennsylvania, but a significant chunk in New York, and about 1 or 2% right on the edge in Maryland where its mouth is. Why is the Susquehanna important? It's about 50% of the watershed area. It's about 50% of the freshwater flow. It's a major source of nitrogen and phosphorus, which I'll show you in just a moment. It has a substantial influence because it's the straight shot down the bay, and it's half the flow, all the way to the mouth of the Potomac. Halfway down the bay, it has a substantial influence on water quality. Water quality in Tangier Sound, across from the Potomac, that's a very important underwater grass area, is impacted substantially by the Susquehanna. Okay. And then the last reason is why I can talk about both the Susquehanna and the bay together is the bay really is the submerged Susquehanna River Valley. So the deep trench of the bay is where the old Susquehanna used to go. When we look up the Susquehanna, our landscape changes from the flatlands around the bay to more rolling and hilly lands, more diverse cropping. I won't talk much about that, but I want to switch gears a bit and go to back down to the bay. The bay suffers from nutrient over-enrichment. I think most of the people in this room are very familiar with how widespread of an issue that has become in the 21st century, basically leading to algal blooms that, as they die off, create an oxygen demand in the deep water, and also, along with resuspended sediment, help to reduce clarity in the shallows. Clarity, that low clarity, kills off the underwater grasses that are really critical habitat for juvenile finfish and many of the mobile shellfish, particularly the crab. Where do the nutrients come from that reach the bay? First, by geographic area, and I just want to point out how important the Susquehanna is. Notice the asterisk by phosphorus. We have effectively the world's largest BMP on the Susquehanna. It's called the Conowingo Dam, and it is trapping about 55% of the sediment and associated phosphorus, at least sediment-bound phosphorus, that's coming over, and that's why you see a lower phosphorus level. However, it is approaching an equilibrium capacity where you will get passed through. And they've been saying that that's 15 to 30 years away for the last 15 years. So I'm getting nervous. The other point that I'll make quickly is the James and York Rivers, which together are important in the total amounts, actually most of what comes down them goes out the bay, goes out the mouth of the bay to the ocean, and they have little influence on in-bay water quality. So that makes the Susquehanna even more important, because you're dealing with a fair part of that pie doesn't have a lot of effect back up the bay. And maybe we ought to go the right direction. The bay has been monitored for 20 some years. I have a 10-year-old cruise, but I could show you one from this summer where we have very low dissolved oxygen in the deep parts of the bay that extend from about Baltimore at the top down off the mouth of the Potomac to slightly below it, where we have low or no dissolved oxygen. And just a quick illustration of why that's important: it got very hot this summer. Striped bass don't like high water temperatures. They normally like to go to deep water for refuge when the water temperatures get high. They hit 30 feet and they ran out of oxygen. So there was another 30 to 130 feet that they could have used, but they basically, it was eliminated as habitat. What are the nutrient sources to the bay? I like, because we're going to focus on agriculture, I want to point out that everything that goes on in the bay contributes to nutrients, and air is a particularly important nitrogen source, as we'll mention now. But when we look at agriculture, we see that both fertilizer and manure sources are very important. Atmospheric deposition of ammonia is also important, obviously much less so, if at all, from phosphorus. Look at the atmospheric deposition of nitrogen at 19%. Now that's non-agricultural, that's NOx. So we're talking about ag here, but I will say reducing NOx falling out of the sky is extremely important to the restoration of Chesapeake Bay, in addition to addressing agricultural sources and municipal point sources. If we look at the Susquehanna, we see a very similar picture with one clear exception, and that is that agriculture is more important. The big cities of Pennsylvania are not in the Susquehanna, so we don't have a lot of big cities. And so when we look at Pennsylvania, it's clear that we're going to have to get major reductions from agriculture to reduce nutrient loads reaching the bay. How important is agriculture? Now, this has to be taken in context of the next slide. It's what percent or fraction of the total loads reaching the bay are attributed to ag. And you'll look at any of the light brown through red colors are greater than 50% of what reaches the bay from those areas are attributable to ag. This is from the USGS Sparrow model. It is across all agricultural land uses, so it's pasture, hay, as well as row crops. The next map, though, is really critical to look at to put that in context, because some of those ag is a dominant source in New York, for instance, in a relatively low loading area. So we're working more and more on targeting to our highest load areas. And here you can see loads in the red going from just over 8 to 30 kilograms per hectare of nitrogen. Now remember, that's averaging across all agricultural land uses. This is for the whole bay. And do I have a pointer handy? I don't think they do. If you look on the right side, that's the the lower right is the Delmarva poultry industry. The left lower is the Shenandoah Valley turkey and dairy production area. The little blob in the middle of red is beef and dairy, well, mainly dairy, in western Maryland and into the edge of Pennsylvania. But that dark red area in the upper right in Pennsylvania is the Lancaster County area. It's very intensive animal agriculture areas, and that is where we tend to see those 30 kilogram per hectare in loads. I think there's a pointer sticking up out there, Pete, if you would grab it. More than 20 years ago, the Chesapeake Bay program was started, and initially it was just a general program focused on let's do something to improve water quality. I've outlined Pennsylvania because I don't think we can overstate the fact that for Pennsylvania in 1983 to say we want to participate in the cleanup of the Chesapeake Bay when we don't own 1 hectare of it was an amazing thing. We all do live downstream, and that became their motto, but their continued involvement, and I'll be honest, some of us downstream would like to say, come on, do more, don't we, Doug? But their continued involvement, I think, is very important because they are the Susquehanna, largely. They are responsible for the Susquehanna load. The loads from New York are very low. And they have been part of the Bay program from the beginning. In 2001, the headwater states of West Virginia, New York, and Delaware also joined in the water quality restoration efforts. Now, there won't be a quiz, and please ignore the complexity of this and pay attention pretty much to the brown, because what I'm really trying to get at is if you're dealing with water quality and nutrients and not worried about setting standards, which is what this group does, two primary centers for the technical work are the Nutrient Subcommittee and the Scientific and Technical Advisory Committee. The Nutrient Subcommittee is part of the organizational structure. It's a line committee that supports management and policy decisions at the science policy interface. It has 6 work groups that you can see here that cover watershed management plans and then the sources. The Scientific and Technical Advisory Committee is just that. It's an independent advisory committee and sets outside of the Bay program, and in the last few years has proven particularly effective at doing good, quick scientific reviews of issues that have occurred and giving answers that weren't always what the Bay program wanted to hear, but were quite important to moving the science forward. So, yes, this is all the bureaucracy and hierarchy of the Bay program, but when we get to water quality, the science part largely passes from these two to what is now called the Water Quality Steering Committee that is made up of upper-level managers and appointees. The governors and their cabinet secretaries do still meet once a year to basically do a public review of progress and to discuss, but most of the work occurs through the Water Quality Steering Committee. There have been a sequence of Chesapeake Bay agreements. I won't go into them other than the 92 tributary-specific ones said, let's try to achieve this 40% reduction, which was just in land-related loads from the 3 signatory states, by writing plans for their watersheds. And then in 2000, we said, under threat of a TMDL, we'll remove all nutrient and sediment impairments. At that time, it said by 2010. It has been admitted that that won't happen, but we will probably go under a TMDL by 2011. This came up in the Mississippi discussion. Virginia and Maryland have standards for the Chesapeake, so they apply to all permitted activities upstream. Now, ag isn't a permitted activity for the most part unless you're dealing with a CAFO, but it certainly does change how everything looks. I want to talk just a bit about our tributary strategies because they are important watershed management plans. They are done on a river-by-river basin, and we do break them by jurisdictional lines and then put them back together. science-based BMP efficiency estimates were developed in 1993, but I'll tell you, in 1993, the science was even weaker than it is today, obviously, and we know it's not as good as we need it to be today. But to our knowledge, that was the first attempt to estimate the effectiveness of specific practices. Strategies were developed based on those efficiency estimates applied to the watershed model that you will hear more about from the next speaker. And these strategies would achieve that 40%, and why it's in quote, it was actually only about a 22 to 24% absolute reduction when you took out air and contributions from the non-signatory states. It was developed in all states with major stakeholder involvement. Maryland created an example that has been followed. They set up agricultural tributary teams in 10 sub-watersheds in the state that told them what would work locally. The technical experts provided the land use data, the ag data, as well as the BMP effectiveness. But then those stakeholder groups that involved the ag and environmental community recommended both the types of practices and the levels of implementation. And they were given several scenarios, like with current resources, with unlimited resources, and with what you think would be the max practical. And from that, we were able to develop some pretty good strategies, and you had local buy-in. Unfortunately, that was later to turn around as we went to regulatory approaches in the post-Fisteria era in the late 90s. I think a weakness of those early 92 strategies that hurt them is that they didn't include implementation or funding plans. They were really nice strategies, but how are you going to get them on the ground, and how are you going to pay for getting them on the ground? However, despite that, there was substantial planning and implementation reported. Monitoring, as I'll show you in a moment, showed some reductions at the fall line at the river input stations, but it was less than what we might have expected. It was pretty easy back then to attribute it to lag times and climatic variability and just say, oh, well, we haven't seen it yet, but we will. But we began to recognize that that probably wasn't true as early as 97, but by 97, we began seeing more reliance on the use of model progress as a public or political statement of actual project progress. People began believing what the model results for progress were saying, and that wasn't a good thing, as we will explain later. However, you must say that this is an impressive reduction at the Conowingo, the mouth of the Susquehanna, 25 and 21% reductions. Much of that, well, certainly some of it was done to good implementation of practices here, but in New York and in some areas of Pennsylvania, there was a lot of abandonment of dairies. And we really see a much less intensive land use in that upper Susquehanna agricultural land use than there was in the mid-80s. But I think the important point is look at all the arrows pointing down. So in the face of growth, some progress was being made, but just nowhere near that, quote, 40% that we needed. So then came along came 2000. We were under the same lawsuits everybody else was over TMDLs, and a new agreement was written that said we will determine the load and then go about removing all nutrient and sediment impairments to the Chesapeake Bay and would implement all the practices, ag, urban, and point source, needed to do that by 2010. When that was being written, we actually all knew that it couldn't be accomplished by 2010. But politics says that sometimes you have to agree to that if you're under a 2011 deadline. And so that was what the governors signed on to. In doing this, it took longer, it took till 2003, but we now have, for Virginia and Maryland, designated uses and water quality standards. We set criteria first, but they now have been adopted as standards for different depths of water, for bay grass areas, and for migratory fish areas, a very complex array, but in the end, it's this deep channel and deep water that is the hardest to achieve, and it actually controls the load allocation back up into all of the tributaries. We have been working long and hard, and these are model-based estimates, but if we had gone from about 340, and excuse the English standard, but million pounds, down to 280 by 2000. And that's as optimistic as you can get because it assumes everything was implemented. Progress has slowed, and we made some adjustments to BMP efficiencies in 2003 that actually took phosphorus back up. And yet we were challenged to write strategies that would take us down to that red line. I was just having a conversation with someone about overuse of the term low-hanging fruit, but maybe it's appropriate here. A lot of the easy reductions had been achieved early, so what was left was more challenging. So the 2003 strategies had to be developed to fully achieve that impairment removal goal. It started with good stakeholder involvement like 1993, but the goals were so challenging that we couldn't get stakeholder consensus, or the states could not get stakeholder consensus on a strategy. So the states took over the goals, and the state strategies ended up requiring near complete implementation of essentially all the major agricultural practices, and it added a number of new practices that we still are working on defining what they are. It also included high levels of urban stormwater management practice implementation, including high levels of retrofit at an extraordinarily high cost, but it was necessary to, quote, be equitable with the suggested agricultural practices. Most sewage treatment plants will go to the limit of technology, and in Maryland and Virginia, there's funding to make that happen over the next 5 to 10 years. And in Pennsylvania, they're taking them not quite to the limit of technology, but are reducing them. However, looking back just in the 5 years since those strategies were done, I think we have to admit that implementation of those extraordinary strategies is unlikely given current approach and political will. And the yellow that I'm going to use in the next several slides say that we need innovation, systems changes, and education for behavior change. We need to step up the science and the outreach that we're bringing to the Chesapeake Bay states if we're going to succeed. The last item before I get to conclusion is something I've worked on a lot, maybe more than I'd ever planned on, is what are the actual impacts of the BMPs? We've seen some improvement, but we report very high levels of implementation of some practices, like 90-some percent of the people in Maryland have implemented nutrient management, according to the state. But these are voluntary, confidential records in public programs. So accountability is very difficult. And we're frequently asked the question, are the practices as effective as you claim? And is ag really implementing what you're claiming is being implemented? And frankly, we're not able to answer them very successfully. And I'll just... By 1997, we had begun to realize that some of our BMP effectiveness estimates were too high, and by 2000, we were talking about concern on over-reliance of the model. In 2003, the Scientific and Technical Advisory Committee held a science forum on issues with BMPs and model use and concluded there were a lot of issues that I'll get to in just a moment. Unfortunately, later that year, the Washington Post, our hometown paper, which is a bit of an issue, ran a series called Bay Progress Overstated that, of course, caught the eyes of everyone in Congress. So we had Government Accounting Office, EPA and USDA, Office of Inspector General, and Congressional Committee reviews of our best management practice issues, which makes for an interesting situation. It actually didn't come out so bad. It found out that, you know, we were doing about as good as anyone, but there were problems and they needed addressing, and maybe we could all learn from some of the things we had done. So in 2006 and 2007, the Bay Program commissioned something that is revising the BMP efficiencies, and I'm helping lead that project. We've completed all the existing practices, and this year are moving into the new practices. What are the reasons that we found for over-optimism in BMP efficiencies? There isn't much data at any scale, and especially not at the small watershed scale. I see a SEEP person sitting in the back of the room, and we're working hard to fix that. We also have the research versus field scale and watershed scale efficiency differences. You try to use research level values, and we're just not seeing them when they're broadly applied. We have spatial, temporal, and management variability. We had assumed complete implementation. If a state reported it as implemented, it was implemented. That needs fixing. It's a difficult policy issue to determine how. Reporting is sort of the same way. And at what point do you say a practice no longer is there? Do you assume it's operated and maintained forever? We have fixed the effectiveness during severe climatic events by just cutting them off once they reach their design storm. If you're interested in that, there is a website that has this report that led to this discussion of these issues. The Bay Program has taken actions to address BMP concerns, and the ones in yellow are ones where they've called on science. We've revised the BMP efficiencies. We've set up a system that requires peer review of all new practices, and we're using the Scientific and Technical Advisory Committee more. We're trying to figure out how to address implementation and operation and management, and probably are going to have to get at the transparency issue in terms of implementation. We're trying to convince people that developing conservative effectiveness estimates, hopefully not just using percentage efficiencies, based on average performance, is where we need to go. It's the figuring out how you go from the literature to those average performance is important. And lastly, we have proposed that we use an adaptive management approach and revise every 3 to 5 years. You can't be revising weekly in a policy setting. So we have to lock them down and then revise them on schedule. And here's just three examples of how we've changed. We no longer report water quality progress based on practice implementation, but we report implementation progress. What percent of what you said you were going to do to achieve your goals have you implemented? And you can see we haven't broken 50%. But this looks minor, but it's a huge turnaround from when it used to be a bar chart that said, here's what the water quality is going to be as a result of implementing these. Now it's saying, what percent of what you said you were going to do have you done? We instead rely more on monitoring. The proof is in the water. And so it's more on monitoring. And while we have seen, you saw this earlier, while we have seen reductions at the fall line station, the Bay has been slow to show a response. And ultimately, we're interested in Bay restoration. We want dissolved oxygen to go up. We want clarity to improve. And there's a last graphic that I don't have an example of yet that I can attribute strictly to nutrient reduction. It would be that we have an increase in living resources in the crabs and fish and shellfish as a result of all the actions. So we have moved away from leaning as much on our model output for results, for progress. It's the only tool we have for estimating how we get there and for projecting the future, as our next speaker will talk about. So in closing, quantitative goals are critical. They need to be science-based, and we think should be focused on restoring the resource as their endpoint. But we may need a surrogate for the goals. Instead of numbers of crabs or fish or even acres of underwater grasses, it's nutrient goals or loading caps. They have to be challenging but credible and achievable. They can't be so far out there that you give up before you get started. So it may be necessary to set interim milestones or interim goals that you move along. And we feel it's critical that you allocate to sub-basins and to the jurisdiction, so each jurisdiction takes ownership of its own nutrient reduction efforts. Strategies are the second step that are equally important. They really need local government stakeholder involvement, and we didn't do that as well in 2003. We need challenging yet credible implementation levels. We either have to have practices that we know we can get people to implement, or we need to plan in advance. What are our programs we're going to do to get this new weird thing that Simpson thought of, this is what frequently happens, to get anyone who really wants to implement it, and that's critical. We need an implementation and funding plan. Right now, we guesstimate it's going to cost somewhere between $500 million and $700 million a year for about a 10 to 15 year period to reach these goals. You need to spell that out. Just walking to Congress and say, do you have a half a million you could give me every year for the next 15 years doesn't work. So we need that plan. It also guides. In closing, we need science for everything we're doing here. Everything above this requires science. And then on top of that, we're going to need innovations and systems changes, because just doing what we currently know how to do well is essential, is critical. But it will not achieve the level of reduction we need. So we need to look at innovation and systems changes. And it's why science is so important. So I close with conclusions so far, because it's a work in progress. And that's maybe the first big conclusion. This is a multi-generational effort. This is not term of office work. And I think that's important. I'm on the Mississippi Hypoxia Panel. We ain't going to fix that next year. But plan for the long term. We've been able to maintain the effort through time, troubles, and politics. Science-based practices and strategies are essential, and yet politics is pulling at you. That sounds so easy. Politics pulls at you. We have made some progress, but it's been very difficult and less than projected, and much more difficult than I think most of us would have ever thought. We obviously need to better understand our current conservation effects, and I wholeheartedly endorse the conservation effects work, but we equally need to look for innovations and systems changes. It's not just the effects of what we're doing today on the cropping systems of today. Adaptive management is critical, but it creates policy challenges. When we made those BMP efficiency changes in 2003, it, quote, reduced progress. It did not. It reduced the model estimate of progress, closer to reality. But a politician had to stand up and explain why they couldn't report any progress for 2003. And a public had to understand that. And so adaptive management, I firmly believe in, but we as scientists have to explain to policymakers and the public how science evolves and how we have to be able to adapt our policies to match up with that adapting science. And maybe the closing shot is that we've used the science-based partnership to make progress, but it has proven a lot harder than we ever thought. And I would encourage you all, there's a website called ChesapeakeBay.net that can be a bit difficult to navigate, but go to Bay Program tab on it. Learn from our experiences. We're to the point that we admit that we've stumbled a few times, that we did some things that weren't wise in hindsight. We don't need, you don't need, to go back and redo our mistakes. We also hope that there are things that you can learn from us that will help your activity succeed better, because we think our partnerships and a lot of our reliance on science has been very helpful in moving us forward.
Thanks a lot, Tom.